The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Lindsay, please call the roll.
Chair Grawl.
Present.
Vice Chair Byrd.
Here.
Republican Whip Gregory.
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll. Representatives Alexander. Beltran.
Here.
Brannon.
Here.
Busada Cabrera.
Here.
Diamond. Duggan.
Here.
Fernandez-Barkin.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Grieco.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Larned.
Here.
Plakin.
Here.
Roach.
Present.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Trunow.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Before we begin, a few reminders. I'll ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. Today, we are welcoming a panel of folks from around the state to talk about our court system, and I want to thank them all for being here. I'm going to give just a brief introduction. We have Chief Judge Lisa Munyon of the 9th Judicial Circuit. She is also the chair of the Florida Court COVID-19 Work Group. We have the Clerk of Circuit Court and Comptroller, Tom Bexley, who was elected as Flagler County's clerk in November of 2016. We also have with us Ed Brodsky, State Attorney for the 12th Circuit, which is Sarasota, Manatee, and DeSoto counties. He is a career-long prosecutor, having served with the State Attorney's Office for 29 years. He also serves as President of the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association. And last, we have Mr. Rex Dimmig, who's a public defender with the 10th Circuit, which is Polk, Highlands, and Hardy counties. He was elected as public defender in 2012, subsequently reelected, and serves as the president of the Florida Public Defenders Association. Thank you all very much for being here today. Members, I've asked that each of the panelists talk to us for about 5 to 7 minutes about the following. I've had the opportunity to speak to most of them over the course of the last week, and I really wanted to have a better understanding of what's happening right now with court operations. How have jury trials resumed? When jury trials have resumed, are the courts disposing of complex litigation and serious criminal matters, or are we handling just those more minor matters? What do the coming months look like because of the delay that some trials and matters have had? We provided some numbers for you in your packet, and really one of the numbers that stood out to me as we engage in this conversation, just so you all know, were the numbers. I asked for the court statistics regarding the number of jury trials that occurred between August of 2018 and August of 2019, so the full year period prior to the pandemic, and then also for the numbers from August of 2020 to August of 2021, so that we could see the comparison. And you will see that there is a sharp decline in the number of jury trials that have occurred in civil cases, which, let me draw your attention to the numbers. It's 731 pre-pandemic, 268 post-pandemic. In circuit civil, in circuit criminal, we are just over 2,600 prior to the pandemic and 943 in the last year. And so that was pretty much the impetus for the discussion. And I think that there's some good information that our panelists have to share with us today about what moving forward looks like. And Chief Judge Munyon, I would appreciate it if you would get us started. Thank you.
Can everybody see me a little better here than seated? I'm not exactly going to tower over anybody. Thank you, Chair Grawl and members, for the opportunity to speak with you on the status of the state court system in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. I recognize that many of you are attorneys and have a grave interest in access to the courts. I also recognize that open, efficient, and effective courts are vital to us all. My name is Lisa Munyon. I am the Chief Judge of the 9th Judicial Circuit, comprised of Orange and Osceola counties. I became the Chief Judge in July after serving as a circuit judge since 2003 in the Criminal Division, Family, Civil, Business Court, and Probate Divisions. Before that, I was in private practice and served as an Assistant State Attorney. Since April of 2020, I've also chaired the court's work group on the continuity of court operations and proceedings during and after COVID-19, which includes judges and court staff from throughout the state. This work group also includes Public Defender Demick, who is here with us today, Clerk Butterfield from Polk County, as well as representatives from the state attorneys, sheriffs, and the Florida Bar. Chief Justice Kennedy established the work group to advise him on the practices and protocols needed to ensure that the court system was operating to the fullest extent possible while protecting citizens, judges, and staff. To that end, and I feel this is really important to note, the judicial branch is in a very unique position. Citizens are summoned to come to the courthouse for jury duty, almost 2 million a year. We also compel others to come before the court as part of the administration of justice. If these people fail to appear, they may be subject to warrants, fines, contempt of court, or adverse rulings. Ensuring the safety of jurors and others who interact with the courts is, of course, a paramount concern for the branch. We are also mindful and appreciative of the COVID civil immunity law enacted by the legislature last year, which requires governmental entities to make a good faith effort to comply with authoritative government-issued health guidance. Throughout the pandemic, the Chief Justice has ensured that statewide operation protocols were in place wherever possible, while giving chief judges the flexibility necessary to address local health conditions and other local issues, which have varied considerably across the state. In the initial months of the pandemic, the court system focused on establishing pandemic operational procedures, continuing essential and critical court proceedings with in-person conduct as necessary, and expanding the court's ability to conduct proceedings by using remote technology when appropriate and effective. Since then, the court system has evolved with the pandemic, always with an emphasis on maximizing operations. The Supreme Court and District Courts of Appeal were largely able to maintain appellate operations with remote oral arguments as necessary. For the trial courts, however, there have been significant challenges. Although it was initially necessary to suspend jury trials, these resumed as conditions improved, at first with masking and physical distancing as recommended by health guidance. The need for physical distancing, of course, has been our biggest challenge in conducting full operations, as it is impossible in some cases due to the size of jury assembly rooms and courtrooms to physically distance prospective and impaneled jurors. To help address this issue, the Chief Justice encouraged chief judges to use non-traditional facilities for in-person proceedings. Eight of our circuits have done this. One example is the Second Circuit, which used a large recreational center to assemble jurors for selection for voir dire for 4 criminal trials and 3 civil trials. Other circuits have considered the use of non-traditional facilities, but have faced obstacles such as the lack of appropriate facilities with necessary technology, insufficient security, particularly for criminal trials, and juror or inmate transportation concerns. Other circuits have used their existing facilities in non-traditional ways, such as placing juries that have been seated in the gallery for the entire duration of the trial instead of the jury box, or having the jury conduct deliberations in the courtroom after having it cleared of all other people. Further, as part of our pandemic response, but also of long-term benefit to court users, the Chief Justice issued the civil case management requirements for all trial courts in March of this year. To expedite the resolution of civil cases, these requirements mandate the issuance of case management orders, setting deadlines that must be strictly enforced for service, discovery, resolution of motions, and mediation. The orders must also specify a projected trial date and indicate that firm trial dates will be ordered when the case is at issue. More recently, in June, when vaccines became adequately available for all adults who wanted one, the Chief Justice lifted the statewide requirements for masking and physical distancing, and instead allowed individuals in a courthouse to choose to wear a mask or to request to be socially distanced during court proceedings. However, due to the substantially increasing new COVID cases in late July, the chief judges were authorized, if warranted by local health conditions, to reinstate mask and social distancing requirements. Once local conditions no longer warrant such requirements, the courts are required to return to the protocols, allowing but not requiring the wearing of masks and physical distancing. Going forward, we recognize that the pandemic may be with us for quite some time. However, we know that this cannot slow the operation of the courts. We are grateful to the legislature for funding the first year of our pandemic recovery plan. We're using this funding to hire temporary adjudicatory and case management resources, which will allow us to enlist senior judges and hire OPS general magistrates and case managers to help with the workload. And we're already working with your Appropriations Committee members and staffers to obtain funding for year two of the plan. Madam Chair, during what has truly been unprecedented times, I believe the branch's response to this pandemic has been measured and thoughtful, particularly given the unique nature of our operations. Going forward, we are committed to working with our criminal and civil justice partners to ensure that the court system is operating to the fullest extent possible while protecting citizens, judges, and staff. Thank you, Chair Grawl, for the opportunity to address the committee today.
Thank you, Judge Munyon. I appreciate you being here. Members, we're going to hear from all the panelists and then open up for questions. Mr. Dimmig, because you also served on the work group, I'd love to hear from you next, please. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. I'm a Luddite with technology, which has been a real challenge for this last 18 months. To let you know a little bit more about me, I have been a practicing attorney in the 10th Judicial Circuit since 1978. Most of my time in that circuit has been as an assistant public defender. I did have a short period of time in which I was in private practice, and I also served 4.5 years as an assistant state attorney. But I have been primarily with the public defender's office since 1988, and as the chair indicated, was elected to be the public defender in 2012. Our experience is that while I serve on the committee with Lisa Munyon, Judge Munyon, and the rules that have been put into place have been good, the practice hasn't always met with the rules. What we learned when the pandemic first struck in March of 2020 is that our court system was woefully unprepared for a circumstance as significant, as impactful, and as lengthy as COVID-19 has proven to be. The first problem that was encountered was a transportation one, because some of the agencies weren't talking to one another. The Sheriff's Department stopped transporting people from one jail to another. The Department of Corrections and the Sheriff's Department quit transporting people from jails to state prisons. The Department of Juvenile Justice stopped transporting juveniles from their detention centers to the state facilities. Department of Children and Families stopped transporting people who had been found incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity to state hospitals for treatment. So the county jails became the warehouse, if you will, for a lot of people who did not need to be there. And there wasn't the coordination. Fortunately, the Chief Justice addressed some of those issues as it relates to people who were arrested in one county on a warrant from another county, but some of the other issues still to this day remain unresolved, and transportation is not totally back up to normal. But perhaps the most troubling thing from a trial lawyer's perspective is that on March the 13th of 2020, the Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court entered an administrative order suspending the constitutional right to trial by jury. To the best of my knowledge, certainly during my experience as a practicing attorney, it's the first time trials have been suspended. Now, there have been other short-term emergency situations, such as hurricanes and things of that nature, where speedy trial rules, the length of time you have before a case has to be brought to trial, has been extended. But that isn't the situation we experienced in March of 2020. If everybody was ready, if the defense was ready, if the prosecution was ready, if the judge was ready, if the courthouse was available, if there were jurors available, didn't matter. You could not do a trial. You were prohibited by administrative order from conducting a trial. And that period went on from March the 16th of 2020 until the last date that the Chief Justice set a definite date was February the 17th of 2020. But then he entered an order that said, wait a minute, they remain suspended until health conditions in your particular county are such that it is safer to be able to conduct a trial. And this is civil trials as well, not just criminal trials. And I think what I would like to point out is that that showed was while there is appropriately a high degree of focus on public health and protecting jurors who are called in and other witnesses and parties who come to the court, like with all constitutional rights, there has to be a balancing. And the balancing was off, in the opinion of the Florida Public Defender Association. A great deal of care for public safety, but suspension of the right to a trial by jury for months and months and months. Whereas there was less focus on what compromises can be made until much further along in this particular process. Yes, eight circuits have used the alternative areas that are available. But I can tell you, for instance, in my circuit, we didn't use any alternative locations except for once. That was in Highlands County, and it wasn't in response to the pandemic. It was in response to the fact that there was a flood because of a waterline break in the courthouse. Within 48 hours, they were able to try cases in the county commission building right across the street. But as soon as the flood conditions were improved, back into the courthouse and continued cessation of jury trials. So the balance is one of the things that needs to be focused on going forward. Yes, care about public health, public safety, but also make sure we're preserving the constitutional rights, not just of criminal defendants, not just of civil litigants, but of the victims as well. Marcy's Law was passed a couple of years ago. Victims have a right to a speedy trial in Florida, and they were denied the right to have a trial for all those months as well. Certainly, circumstances have been different in other places in the state. No two circuits or no two jurisdictions here are exactly identical. Some places dealt with things extremely well, others did not. Technology has been a wonderful thing, some places. And other places, technology has proven to be an obstacle rather than a benefit. The ability of an attorney to carry on a confidential attorney-client communication with an incarcerated client has been severely impacted in many of the jurisdictions. While the courts have been able to conduct remote court proceedings, during the course of that court proceeding, to have a separate independent means by which the attorney can confidentially communicate with their client has proven to be much more challenging and much more of a technology issue than was originally anticipated. And then I would be remiss not to talk about, as we move forward, that there has been a substantial change in employees' belief pattern, if you will, about work. The work-life balance that When I was a young assistant public defender, the work-life balance meant you worked 80 hours a week and you partied hard when that time was over. So it was work hard, party hard, party hard. And what did we learn? The suicide rate amongst criminal trial lawyers was amongst the highest of any organization or any group of people, any occupation in the entire state. The current group of employees learned during the course of COVID that, wait a minute, there's opportunities to work from home. Wait a minute, we've lost family members, so we don't want to put in those 80-hour weeks. We want to be able to have a better work-life balance. And what that has resulted in is massive resignations from both public defender, and I won't speak for Mr. Brodsky, but prosecutors' offices as well, and a great difficulty in hiring people for those positions. So you've got two problems. You've got the backlog of cases from when we couldn't do case trials and when trials have been at a slower rate, building up and up, and our staffing levels going down and down. The net result is we're not moving cases at the rate that could be moved. We still are not back to normal. And quite frankly, in some jurisdictions, some of the cases that are going to trial are not the most significant of cases. In my circuit, we're trying way too many misdemeanor cases and not enough felony cases. Why? And I know I'm taking too long here, but why? Florida has a speedy trial rule, or at least we did up until March the 16th of 2020. That rule has been suspended. The rule simply said that if you're charged with a felony, you have to be brought to trial within 175 days of when you're taken into custody. If it's a misdemeanor, you have to be brought to trial within 90 days. If you are not, nope, you don't go out. You don't walk free at that point. That used to be the rule when I was a brand new defense attorney, but that's not the rule anymore. If you hit those deadlines, there must be a hearing held in front of the court within 5 days. And then there's a 10-day window of recapture that the trial must be held within those 10 days. With the exception of one case where the fact situation is truly unique, I can't recall a case in the last 10 years in which someone has walked free on a speedy trial rule situation. But we've suspended speedy trial. And speedy trial is what pushes both sides. When you know a case is going to trial, when the prosecution sits there and says, I've got to have my witnesses here. When the defense says, I've got to put on this theory of defense that I have. They come together. That's the engine that drives the criminal justice system. The threat of trial. Not the trial. We can do lots of trials, but there's got to be the threat of trial to cause people to come together to resolve those cases. 96% of all criminal cases in Florida resolved by way of a negotiated plea agreement. When there isn't that pressure, those cases are not going to be resolving at the rate they need to resolve, and we're going to find ourselves trying those cases that are less important. I've taken way too much time, Madam Chair. I apologize, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Dimmick.
Thank you.
Mr. Brodsky, I'd love to hear from you, please. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Good morning, Chair Grawl and members. I'd like to say good morning also to my representative from back home, District 73, representing Manatee and Sarasota, Representative Tommy Gregory. My name is Ed Brodsky, and I serve as the State Attorney for the 12th Judicial Circuit, representing Manatee, Sarasota, and DeSoto counties. It's also my honor to serve as the President of the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and as Chair Grawl said, I've been with the state attorney's office now for 29 years, and I'm in my third term as the elected state attorney. This morning, I was asked to speak to you and with our fellow members here about the criminal courts and the backlog and perhaps some thoughts and observations about what can we do to get our way out of this. This time last year, in October of 2020, the Florida trial judges came before the Florida legislature and asked for $16 million. To handle increased workloads associated with the COVID-19 pandemic with what was then estimated to be a backlog of almost 1 million cases. Circuit Judge Steinbeck, who was the chair of the Trial Budget Commission, estimated that the courts would require over the next 3 years some $37 million and 300 judicial or quasi-judicial positions. The Trial Budget Commission estimated by June 30 of 2021 that there would be nearly 5,000 jury trials that would be delayed because of the pandemic. The Office of the State Court Administrator is here, and her staff are here, and they've been wonderful in providing information to all of you and certainly in providing information to my office as I prepared for this. And as was reported by the chair, when you compared the last fiscal year, 1920, to fiscal year 2021, in circuit court, felony court, we saw a 35.7% reduction in trials during the pandemic. And in county court, we saw almost a 46% reduction in trials. So we know that caseloads are increasing, trials are decreasing. We also know that if you look right now at open felony cases that are across the state of Florida in our circuit courts, that we have now almost 25,000 more cases in our felony courts. That is a 50% increase from the previous year. In our county court, we have 31,000 more cases than we did previously, about 38% increase. And in our criminal traffic, which is a lot of the bread and butter where our misdemeanor attorneys practice with DUIs and cases of that sort, 68,230 more cases, or a 65% increase in the workload that our prosecutors are carrying. In a series of administrative orders, as was discussed here with the COVID work group through orders by the Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, Chief Justice Charles Kennedy, he instituted a number of measures and I wanted to discuss some of them because for prosecutors and for public defenders in the trial courts, I think they've been very helpful. And these are things that we'd certainly like to see perhaps continued and looked at by the legislature. But one of the things that was extremely helpful in a time of remote technology was the administrative order allowed for the administration of oaths by notary, remotely, by audiovisual means, which was very helpful to our assistant state attorneys. A judicial circuit, they were allowed to remotely conduct criminal jury trials throughout the state and to do jury proceedings, jury selection proceedings. I'd venture to say that there were probably very few, if any, of those that occurred. But that was something that was allowed by the extension through the order. Speedy trial was extended, something that Mr. Deming has talked about. And the first of those speedy trial periods has elapsed for those that were taken into custody prior to March of 20. And there will be another speedy trial expiration coming up this January. And some of the things that Chief Justice Kennedy built in are some exceptional circumstances that allow for the continuances to be extended, those time periods to be continued, depending on the congestion of the dockets, depending on courtroom space, the availability of jurors, and personnel staffing issues such as the public defender's office, the state attorney's office, clerks, and judges. Something that I personally have seen that I think has been very beneficial to us because of the pandemic, because of COVID restrictions, because of transportation issues, has been the authority for those that are arrested on warrants and capuses and violations of probation warrants from around the state in jurisdictions other than the jurisdiction in which they committed the offense, is the authority of the trial judge to conduct first appearance, to be able to hear those cases and to be able to resolve those cases. I think that that's been very, very helpful to all of us in helping to expedite cases. But what we have seen due to the pandemic is we've seen increased caseloads at the assistant public defenders, the state attorney's office, obviously the courts, the clerks, and the work that's happening. But when you talk to your local law enforcement, you talk to your sheriffs, and you ask about jail capacity, that's something that we as prosecutors discuss with our sheriffs. What we're being reported is our jails are getting full. Right, we're starting to have overcrowding issues within our county facilities. And the folks that are in our county facilities right now are those that are committing violent and dangerous felonies. And those cases are languishing and not being able to be tried. So that is a concern to all of us in public safety. We've seen cases that have had to be continued even though trial courts opened up. We had law enforcement officers that either had COVID or were in quarantine. We had witnesses, victims, attorneys. So even though courts had opened up, we were experiencing delays beyond our control. So what we've experienced is that every attorney in our office, I think, can say that we've seen at least a 25% increase at a minimum in the caseload and the responsibilities that they're handling. We saw that identity has been an issue. A lot of the courts have been requiring masks to be worn in the courtroom, and absent a stipulation to identity, that has hampered us as to how to deal with that and how to overcome that issue when identity is a genuine and germane issue in the trial. And that has caused cases to be continued. And that's something that I think that we need to be able to address, and there needs to be a solution to that so that we're not hampered when a defendant doesn't want to stipulate to identity at trial, which has to be proven, and there is a mask mandate in the courtroom. While video trials have been allowed, and that's something that Chief Justice Kennedy has allowed, while that's probably not going to happen and we're not going to see a lot of video trials occur in the criminal context, we'd love to see some easing of the restrictions that deal with witnesses, allowing witnesses to be able to testify remotely, because we have great technology now. The days of confrontation being an issue, you know, previously are not a concern now when everybody can testify by video. So we'd ask the courts, the legislature, to consider those issues, to modify the notary law for remote administration of oaths to continue, to expand authority over first appearances, VOP warrants, pleas from other circuits that's currently in existence by our administrative order, that be something that perhaps be extended through the legislature. We need to prioritize in-custody defendants, the handling and the resolution of in-custody defendants. I think that there needs to be more emphasis put on identifying defendants that have no record or there are probation offers on those cases and moving those cases to the front of the docket and making sure that those cases are heard early and often. One of the things that there has been a lot of discussion, and I know the Florida Bar commissioned the trial lawyer section to do a white paper with recommendations about how to come out of COVID. And one of the things that they said, and there's a lot of discussion about, is let's increase judges. Let's create more magistrates. Let's create more judges. The problem is that when you do that, particularly in criminal court, that what you're doing is you're straining the public defenders, you're straining the assistant state attorneys, and they're overwhelmed, and there's only one prosecutor that can't be in multiple courtrooms at the same time. Even though you may bring in multiple judges, you're putting a significant strain on those attorneys. So the other thing is there's a few things that I would say that need to be looked at in the court system. We spend a lot of time in the court system, and our attorneys spend a lot of time in the courts dealing with short hearings that deal with case management and that deal with scheduling timetables in a case. Those are things that could be resolved out of court by stipulation by the parties and a focus by the courts dealing with bail hearings, motions, pleas, trials, and sentencing hearings and avoiding all these time scheduling hearings that are occurring in court. To incentivize early and quick identification and triage of those defendants that have mental health illnesses or substance abuse or that need to be in treatment courts. All of us now at the state attorney's office are running a number of specialized treatment courts. And we need to quickly identify those people and get them into treatment and move them out of the court system into services. And that's something that we're not seeing enough of. Perhaps what we could do, you know, is more of a triage, and instead of making first appearances and instead of making arraignments so perfunctory, there could be more time and discussion about the resolution of the case or identifying the needs of the accused and getting them into the services that they need. A speedy trial is something that Mr. Deming has talked about. I can tell you that it is, as we've had a number of meetings as an association and our board members, speedy trial is a concern. You know, with the number of cases that we are facing right now, we're facing an unprecedented time with the number of cases that we're handling. There's a number of circumstances in which Justice Charles Kennedy has allowed the extension. We think that those extensions need to remain. I mean, there is a lot of discussion that speedy trial will be abused, and we don't think that speedy trial right now, we are facing unprecedented times. And public safety is paramount while we do balance the rights of the accused. We know that they have a right to trial, and I think that we're all working very diligently within our association to make sure that the accused have their right to trial. But it needs to be balanced. And I appreciate Mr. Demick's comments about victims, because as we go through this process, we do hear from victims that are frustrated by the delays in criminal justice, and that they feel that their day in court and justice has not been served. So we ask that we always remember our victims also deserve justice, that they also deserve a right to be informed, present, and heard. With that, I will.
Thank you, Mr. Brodsky.
Thank you so much. Here.
Clerk Bexley, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for inviting me. A lot of passionate comments by my colleagues today. I'll keep mine to a minimum so we can get to your questions. I think that's the important part of this gathering today. Again, I'm Tom Bexley, clerk and comptroller in Flagler County. I'm also the legislative chair for our association, the Florida Court Clerks and Comptrollers. I truly appreciate this opportunity to provide you with a perspective of clerks of court today and participate. One of our key values as clerks is adapt to succeed, which is what we've done over the past year and a half to ensure critical services and access to justice remain available to citizens. Clerks have worked together throughout the state, along with our judicial partners, to navigate these very challenging times while continuing to serve our constituents. We've adjusted to the challenges of court closures, remote hearings, jury trials with reduced capacities for jury pools, and an ever-changing landscape based upon local, county, and circuit conditions. We've leveraged existing technology and helped self-represented Floridians, our pro se litigants, learn how to use electronic filing for their court documents, to attend court events, and even receive information on their specific court events electronically. The e-filing portal has been an invaluable asset to the continuance of court operations. I think we all learned that there's a great benefit in using technology during these times. Increased use of technology creates a need for more financial resources to continue to provide services in this ever-changing environment. Clerks have found, though, that there are two distinct phases in this court reopening process. The current Supreme Court administrative order provides local chief judges a lot of discretion in their particular circuits. Clerks are there to support and to adjust to those local preferences. As conditions have changed and have been different throughout the state, there have been a variety of challenges in continuing these court operations, including types of facilities, the layout of the current courthouse, if the county has multiple courthouses, the ability of jury pools, local response to CDC guidelines, and the various waves of this devastating pandemic. These adjustments are specific to each county. Some counties are much larger than others and have more substantial amenities. Some are smaller and have far less. Of specific interest is the clerk's role to summon jurors. It's been a bit mixed. Some counties have been able to move forward fairly well, but many clerks have faced challenges finding willing jurors to participate, resulting in a need for additional summons to go out and increase requests for excusals. When that occurs, clerks need to work with their local judges, and that can vary as well from county to county. I've spoken with clerks around the state, and it's common to see very low juror responses to summons. We have reported yields ranging from 20 to 50%. 20% is one in five people summons actually showing up and doing their duty. Further, having available space to allow for safe participation in the jury process has also been a factor. For example, due to social distancing preferences in some jury assembly rooms, jury pools were reduced from, say, 100 prospective jurors down to 30. This is the difference between calling enough jurors to accommodate 3 to 4 trials down to just one. We've gotten very creative in finding ways to make sure these important proceedings continue, such as calling jurors multiple times per week rather than having one big cattle call like on a Monday morning, and of course, moving to larger facilities when possible. It should also be noted we have faced staffing issues to the current employment market, as well as employees themselves being impacted by the pandemic. At the beginning of the pandemic, due to the unique way clerks are funded, many of us had to furlough or lay off employees due to budget constraints. Looking ahead, we now face an increased workload to help support the courts with a backlog of cases in the midst of a challenging employment market. It is important to recognize this is going to take a while to work through the backlog of cases and to get back to normal operations. I want to thank you all for providing additional resources last year that assisted with this backlog and in passing Senate Bill 838, which allowed us to stabilize this free fall that we've all found ourselves in. There is a backlog of cases, but clerks are confident with the continued partnership and a focus on sufficient resources, we can adequately support our judicial partners and provide the services necessary to efficiently address this backlog. In terms of policy, we believe in continuing to share and codify creative solutions and best practices that are working in various circuits, and perhaps standardize some of those to ensure the judicial system continues to operate no matter what we face in the future of this pandemic. On behalf of Clerks of Florida, we appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective. We remain committed to serving and supporting our judicial partners and providing important services. Thank you. I look forward to the continued discussion.
Thank you, Clerk Bexley. Members, we're going to open it up for questions at this time. I am happy to allow some questions to go back and forth between the panelists and the members of the committee. I would just ask that you wait till the you finish your question. Make sure you direct it to the panelists that you would like to address it. When you finish your question, please don't talk over each other and try and be respectful of the process. And we'll rein it back in if we have to. And there's too much talking over each other. So with that, Representative Roach, you can get us started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you'll indulge me, I do have one question for Mr. Deming and one question for Mr. Bexley. But first of all, thank you all for highlighting these issues. I've spent some time speaking with my state attorney and a public defender in the 20th Judicial Circuit. They've brought up many of the concerns that you have. But my first question for Mr. Deming, you know, you had mentioned and spoke a little bit about the speedy trial clock and then what happens when you get to the end of that and a possible hearing and extension. And you mentioned that people aren't going to be released and go free. But my question is, at what point do we have an obligation to let them go free? I mean, assuming we get an extension and another extension, I mean, at what point do we have, you know, a constitutional violation where we do have to let people out and not just detain them indefinitely?
Thank you for that question. Under the rule that is currently suspended, at least for people who were arrested after March 13th of last year, if you have that five-day hearing after the 175 or 90 days has expired, and then the case is not brought to trial within the 10-day window, during COVID, that window has been extended to 30 days. At that point, you would be a defendant would be entitled to complete release on the case. If the speedy trial rule were to be abolished or further extensions permitted, then you have constitutional speedy trial, which the feds have had to deal with constitutional speedy trial because they do not have a speedy trial rule. Florida's had a speedy trial rule for decades and decades. So unfortunately, we don't have any good information about what the Florida courts would interpret as a reasonable period of time under constitutional speedy trial.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the answer. And then, Mr. Bexley, you had mentioned that one of the things you were working on or would be a proponent of is codifying what you call the best practices that some of the other judicial circuits are doing. I'm wondering if you could share with the committee what some of those best practices are so that we may look at codifying them in state law.
Chair, okay to address individually? Thank you, Rep. Roach. I appreciate the question. I don't want to get too deep into it because I think I'm stepping on some of my colleagues' toes. I think mentioned earlier was our ability to virtually swear in and provide oaths to witnesses. Those are just some of the things. And the idea of virtual hearings and court appearances, I think it's been used limitedly for a number of years, first appearances. It's been used much more widespread, and be very careful not to step on any legal toes. It's working for us functionally because we don't have to send people all over the place. They can remain at their desks, and it just helps to streamline the process. So I think that's about as far as I'll go. But if any of my colleagues have any great ideas, we're definitely there for support.
Representative Larned, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for the judge, if that's okay. And I'm only addressing you because I think you can probably talk to the entire system a little bit. A couple weeks ago at our last committee week, those of us who are on the Justice Appropriations Committee heard some pretty hard-hitting testimony from the Department of Corrections about the staffing level that they described as a crisis inside the prisons. The secretary sent a letter saying that he would, if we didn't take action, he might have to release inmates because he can't house them safely. My question for those of us who want to try to help the receiving end of our court system and where these, those who are found guilty go, is it safe to say that the situation in our prisons is going to get worse? Because what I'm understanding from this testimony is that we're going to be sending more people to prisons in the next couple months than we have in the last couple. Is that a fair assessment as to what the future looks like?
I don't, Chair Grohl, may I?
You're recognized, and to the extent that you have a response today, I know that that might be outside the scope of what they prepared for, but if you have a response and maybe can help get some information after, we'd appreciate it.
All right, thank you. I don't have any statistics on those issues. However, I do believe that common sense would tell us if you have cases that would have been tried in the last year and have not been tried, a percentage of those cases in circuit criminal are going to go to prison. So you may see a temporary uptick in the number of people that go at one time, but over time it should even out. But that is completely anecdotal and from my 35 years in the criminal justice system.
Follow, Madam Chair?
Thank you. Yes.
My follow-up is actually for Mr. Brodsky, if that's okay. I'm not a lawyer. I have zero experience with court systems in general. So I wanted to ask you mainly about prosecutorial discretion. And my understanding of criminal justice overall is we're asking a lot of you guys, obviously. You're trying to prosecute lots of people for lots of things. And from what I'm hearing is that you don't have the capacity to do that. So what is that decision-making process like as far as what cases you decide to take to trial? I mean, I was shocked to learn that 96% end in a plea. So are you trying to incentivize those just to help with your workload? How do you at your level help manage this docket?
Well, I appreciate the question, and I too listened to Secretary Inch's testimony before the legislature, and we're very aware of the concerns that the Florida Department of Corrections is under, and certainly now we're seeing the concerns that our county jail facilities are under. So we know that there's immense pressure on the correctional side. We know there's immense pressure on the court side. But all of us, I think, among the 20 elected state attorneys in our respective offices, I can tell you that we use our prosecutorial discretion very carefully. We understand that there are, huge limitations right now, and so we are very careful. And that's why one of the things I talked about in my remarks has to do with identifying those individuals that should go into treatment programs and that should go into diversion programs. We all have very robust pretrial intervention programs to quickly identify low-risk offenders, no record, to get them off to pretrial intervention programs to alleviate them from going into the criminal justice system. We all run different types of diversionary programs to help stem the number of cases that are going into the flow of the criminal justice system. And we are, I think we're mindful of the cases that we are prosecuting, and we take that responsibility very solemnly to make sure that we are filing, the appropriate cases and bringing the appropriate cases into the criminal justice system. And we're working very closely with our law enforcement partners, and I think we have lots of communication with them about alternatives. I mean, one of the things that we've been pioneering, and I certainly pioneer in my circuit, is juvenile civil citation. And a lot of circuits have implemented adult civil citation. I think these are all conversations that we're going to be continuing to have. The conversation, as I've said previously, the conversation that occurred with a prosecutor's office 20 years ago is a much different conversation today in light of where we are and the criminal justice reforms that have taken place.
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized for question.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Bexley, this question's for you, and at the risk of probably offending many civil practitioners in the state of Florida, I handle criminal cases, and I see a great inequity, at least in my opinion, between the court costs in a criminal case and the court costs in a civil case. And I hear you loud and clear when you say we need more financial resources and the focus is on sufficient resources. If you know, when's the last time we raised civil filing fees? Because those cases last an inordinate amount of time compared to criminal cases. And I see my criminal clients paying $400 on count one, $200 on count two, $600 on count three. When's the last time, and would that help if we raised civil filing fees?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the question. I could go down a real long rabbit hole on that. But we had an increase to certain parts, traffic being one of them. I don't know exactly how long it's been. I want to say in the last 10 to 15 years. I wasn't even a clerk when this happened. And I think there were issues with that. I mean, the immediate thought when you raise the price of something is you're going to get more money because people are going to continue to consume the same amount. I'm not sure if that's the case. We've noticed a declining amount of traffic citations being issued, and I know that doesn't fully address your thoughts there, but I'm not sure if that model wouldn't be the same if we went in and increased filing fees and et cetera. And I also want to say, being a conservative man and being very interested in the rights of the people, we're very hesitant on ever raising any taxes and or any fees, although I understand it's absolutely necessary and that we do come to you from time to time to ask for such increases. So I think that's kind of where we are. I hope that kind of addressed your question, but that's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't want to deter anybody from having access to courts either, but if the fees aren't in line, with what's appropriate, might that be something that you could suggest higher fees, or is that something you think that we should study moving forward to help in some of the, resource areas that you're talking about?
Yeah, I get you. Right now, our only option if we want to increase our piece of the pie is to change the distribution of how the fees that are generated from those type cases are distributed to the different parties involved. And the problem with that is you got some winners and you got some losers. And the last thing I want to do is cost any of my colleagues any parts of their budgets. So I think a conversation about an increase in fees is always one that needs to be had. We're very cautious that we don't stop anybody's access to justice by doing that, just like you mentioned. So
understood. Thank you.
Cautious.
Thanks, Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That sparks some follow-up questions for me. Good morning, Mr. Clark. So it sounds, though, like what Rep. Gottlieb was asking is it possible to increase the civil fines in such a way that maybe they would be in parity with the criminal fines and fees? Because if I'm not mistaken, and I'm a civil litigator, so I don't know a ton about the fines and fees on the criminal side, but it sounds to me, based on what Rep. Gottlieb was saying, if we have criminal defendants who are being charged fines and fees per count, that could reach into the several hundreds or several thousands. So if that's the case, why is there not the parity on the civil side?
I think it's definitely a bigger discussion. I want to be very cautious about ever suggesting that there be increases and to impede the ability and access to justice. But yeah, I agree. There comes a point when the monies that are being provided aren't compensating the parties involved for the services that are providing, and we could be at that point.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask some questions about the driver's licenses and suspensions? Driver's licenses and suspensions and how those fees are generated? Mr. Clark, would you be able to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very well aware of those.
Is it kind of within the scope of the meeting today with court operations? We did not speak about that beforehand, so I don't know the extent to which the clerk came prepared to talk about details. So if there's a question that he can answer, I'm happy to let you ask it, but it may take us down a different rabbit hole that
right.
is outside of the scope of the meeting.
Okay, let me float it and see if that works, if that's okay, Madam Chair. Like the general sense was, because with the pandemic, it's my understanding that perhaps there have been there's been less of an opportunity to collect those sorts of fines and fees that are generated from license suspensions. So I was wondering if you could speak maybe broadly to the economic impact that that has had on the system. But if not, I'm happy to follow up with you at some other time after.
Oh, I'd love to. Absolutely. We've talked about this for several years. There have been several pieces of legislation by parties on our side and conflicting sides talking about the idea of what exactly does a suspension do to as a repercussion to non-payment of fines. I'm not sure if that's exactly your question. I guess more of our concentration when it comes to that issue is to make people accountable for what they did, but to be fair in the process. The laws are on the books, and we're just here to basically do our job and collect the fees that are associated. What we want to do is make it easier for people to be in compliance and continue to drive. And by crafting creative payment plans and working with individuals, that's our goal. The last thing we want to do is have the implication of cash register justice, because that's not a good place to go. But we're working within the rules that are we have to right now, so we're doing the best we can. I hope that helped.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Beltran, did he? I will come back to him. Representative Hart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure which one of you all may be able to answer me. I can't remember who talked about the funding aspect. But if you were getting additional money, I did hear you say that case managers and magistrates would help. What else could those dollars help you with if we were able to give you more funding?
Nice, Judge Mannion.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hart. We do have a phase our year two to our pandemic recovery plan, and it does include additional resources for adjudicatory staff, such as money to pay senior judges to come preside over cases, and money for OPS magistrates. OPS magistrates have been very helpful in resolving cases, especially in county court in the civil arena. We have also used the dollars that you provided last year and need continued support for case managers. And case managers, by and large, are focused around the state on civil case management to move those civil cases through the system that have not been able to move or not move in sufficient numbers during the pandemic.
Yes, you may.
So I appreciate the question. From our perspective, I think from the state attorney's office perspective, I can tell you, and I think that Jack Campbell, who is our vice president and the state attorney here for the Second Circuit, he's going to be speaking tomorrow in the House and in the Senate on our budget proposal. And retention is a big part of it. I think that now as we're facing this pandemic, you know, being able to retain these bright lawyers to do the work, I think in my office and at the public defender's office, and he touched upon it, I think is going to be crucial. And so retention and being able to make sure that we have adequate staff on hand to address these cases is going to be very important, just as it is for the courts to have judges.
Thank you. Representative Beltran, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, if I may. The first is some of the speakers have mentioned remote hearings. I understand in the criminal context you certainly can't do a trial. You got confrontation clause. You probably don't want to do an evidentiary hearing remote. How are the hearings working for non-evidentiary hearings, status conferences, cattle calls, things of that nature? And are they something that you all are comfortable continuing, pandemic or no pandemic, as a general practice, being in the 21st century and saving time and travel and logistics and all that? And I'd like to hear from the whole panel if I can.
Well, thank you for that question. I'll speak from the defense point of view. A lot depends on the quality of the technology that's available. If we are able to have a confidential attorney-client conversation, we are not opposed to doing some of those kinds of activities in a remote fashion. But let me tell you, we are now doing, in my circuit, our chief judge has entered an order that anyone who is incarcerated, all of their court proceedings, with the exception of evidentiary hearings and jury trials, must be conducted remotely. Well, I'm going to be accused of defending prosecutors here in a minute, but I will. Because their caseload is so high, we frequently get the offer of settlement in a case, the negotiated plea offer, literally an hour or two before the arraignment hearing. We do not have the opportunity to communicate that to the client who is in the jail. So what you have is now this case has come, they have an offer, it may be an offer for time served where they can plea and get out of jail. But because the attorney cannot communicate confidentially with his client or her client, that case gets postponed. So one of the things that I'm going to be asking, and our representative tomorrow is going to be asking both in the House and then Thursday in the Senate or vice versa, help with the technology. You know, Revision 7, Article 5 says technology became a county responsibility. Well, we've got to have improved technology in our jails so that not only can the court proceeding itself take place, but so that the attorneys can have their communications with their clients so that when you get to the court proceeding, you're actually able to accomplish something.
Mr. Brodsky.
So from, I think from a prosecutor's perspective, I can tell you, you know, largely the attorneys like it. I mean, that it certainly added a lot of convenience to the attorneys, you know, from a lot of the time that is spent in court waiting for a case to be called. But sometimes, you know, when a judge is ready to call a particular case, what I've seen personally, because I watched a lot of these court hearings, the attorney isn't ready or the attorney isn't available or the defendant isn't available. So it's been a little bit of a mixed bag in that regard, and I've witnessed judges literally phoning an attorney's office, trying to get a hold of the attorney, trying to get a hold of the client, you know, unusual circumstances and where the accused is, you know. So that's been good. We've had some questions about whether or not judges can take pleas remotely, and we've had some judges that are uncomfortable with it, some judges that are very comfortable with it. So that might be an area to look at, is the authority to take pleas and what that looks like for judges. But overall, I think that they've liked it. It's been a significant convenience to the attorneys. There's downsides and there's upsides to doing it, though.
Judge Mannion.
Thank you. I think from a statewide perspective, you will find that the use of technology has been successful in some parts of the state and has been less successful in others. A lot of it depends upon how prepared the court was and the other justice partners to deal with technology before the pandemic. And I think all of us at the beginning of the pandemic were not thinking that we would still be talking about it 18 months later. And you know, many at the beginning chose, you know, to sort of wait it out because they didn't think that we would need to use this technology for a substantial period of time. And we have had to use it. And it's been successful in the areas that were prepared and in the areas that had the infrastructure for the technology. I know that there are some circuits in the state that don't have broadband internet available readily in rural communities. And it's been very challenging to deal with technology and remote appearances in those areas. So there's work to be done. I think it has potential.
Clerk Bexley.
Thank you, Chair. I think the idea of new cutting-edge technology, it's not a want anymore. It's a need. It's the new standard. But I also understand that hesitating on something new is human nature. We all do it. There's a little thing called the Florida Court e-filing portal that 10 years ago was kind of obscure and we weren't sure it was going to catch on. I can't tell you how much time it saved attorneys, litigants, clerks, all of my justice partners over here in not having to physically go to a courthouse and stand at a counter or stick something in the mail and hope it gets there and I'll hear back eventually. June of this year, we had our largest month ever with 1.9 million submissions, 2.8 million documents consisting of almost 14 million pages. So we've always embraced it. And I can tell you locally in Flagler County, we have a group that meets quarterly where we meet with all of the partners between the court, state attorney, and public defender with our county who is required to provide these resources. And we work very well together and we leverage our money on technology so it works for all of us.
Thank you. Representative Beltran, you have another question?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you all for your answers. Sorry about that. A second question is, at least two of the panelists mentioned masking. I'm just going to say, like it is, there's only a couple of people in this room. There's probably 50 at least people in this room. A couple of us are wearing masks. That's everyone's prerogative. I don't wear the mask unless I go to court or to the doctor's office because that's where I'm required to wear it. Why are we required to wear the mask in court? Whose policy is that? Is that circuit by circuit? Is that something from coming from above? And three of you are elected officials, so don't be shy. You don't owe your job to anyone but the electorate. I just want to hear your thoughts on, maybe you think we should wear the mask. I don't know. I just want to hear your thoughts again from the perspectives that we have, please. Thank you.
Judge Mannion, or would you like to hear from everybody, Representative, or just... We'll throw it to the panel.
I'd definitely like to hear from Judge Mannion, and if the defender, the prosecutor, and the clerk have opinions as well, I'd like to hear those. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Mannion.
Thank you. Masks were mandated until the Chief Justice entered AOSC 21-17, I think the first one, indicating that once local health conditions permitted, masks were not, or gave a deadline for when masks no longer would be mandated in the courthouse. Then we hit July, which was an unprecedented uptick in pandemic due to the Delta variant. So the Chief Justice permitted each chief judge to determine based on local health conditions whether masks and/or social distancing should be required in a county within the circuit or circuit-wide. And that order also indicated that once health conditions returned to acceptable levels, that the mask mandates and or social distancing should be terminated.
Mr. Dimmick.
The administrative order that was referred to does indicate that only if the juror or a witness or spectator wants to wear a mask, they're allowed to. If they want to socially distance, the court has to permit that. And I think that is a good solution to that. I was not particularly in favor of when we went back to requiring masks in the courtroom because it's what I talked about when I was at the podium of the balancing. Yes, we need to be careful to make sure that we don't spread the virus any further, but in terms of due process, we tell jurors, a standard jury instruction at the close of every criminal trial is, in evaluating the credibility of a witness, you are to consider the way the witness acted as well as what they said. Well, when you can't see from here down, how do you really evaluate? So are we telling these jurors, do something, you take an oath to do something you physically can't do if we have a mask on? So I think we need to strike a better balance between, you know, protecting the rights for public health, but also protecting the rights of all of the litigants who are in the courtroom. So I'm not in favor of masks in the courtrooms.
Thank you, Mr. Dimmick. Mr. Brodsky?
And I'll just add, I'll agree with, you know, I think the masks have been an impediment. I mean, you know, I think that now the administrative order that was referenced does allow the chief judge under local conditions to determine the needs. And we did, in my circuit, we did have a spike that occurred in our facilities in our two counties and some of the personnel that were transporting inmates and things like that. So the court, I think, felt that it was appropriate. I think conditions have improved, and we're continuing to see impediments to our trials because of the issues that are being raised here with identification of the suspect and witnesses. And we actually have a trial right now that one of the material witnesses in the case indicated to my prosecutor this week that they refused to come to court. And you can continue the case because they're not coming to court if they're required to wear a mask. So we have seen some issues, and certainly I agree with you, Representative Beltran. You know, we don't see largely in the public sector, right? We're all here largely without masks. It should be something that's optional for those that wish to wear it. And so, frankly, I think that, you know, for both sides, it would be better if it was a condition that was at least at this time removed.
Clerk Bex.
I'll be brief. I totally agree with the rep. When you go to Flagler County, you got to wear a mask in two places, at the courthouse and the hospital. My personal feelings aside, I don't think a piece of T-shirt material and some elastic over your ears is doing much good, and I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fernandez-Barkin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for the public defender and for the state attorney. This idea was brought to me by Mr. Gene Zanobi, who's the head of the ORCC for the 3rd DCA, and that is basically a confidential criminal mediation between the state attorney, the public defender or assigned court counsel, and the criminal defendant, and quite possibly the victim, if the victim wants to be involved in it. And they've had some success in resolving about, they tested this with about 15 cases, and they were able to resolve about 12. And I was just wondering if you think that this is something that would possibly help if we gave you this tool as a legislature to exercise this opportunity. Do you think that this would possibly help alleviate the backlog?
Nice, Mr. Jimmy.
Thank you. Any opportunity that increases the opportunity for defense counsel and prosecutors to talk about a resolution of a case would be welcome. Unfortunately, because of the caseloads right now, that's a problem. When attorneys are in court 4, 5, 6 hours a day, defense lawyers are going down to jails to see clients, the opportunity to have meaningful conversations with prosecutors has taken a hit. So as long as it's not mandatory, I do not believe in mandatory mediation type of situations in criminal cases, but voluntary, strongly encouraged even mediations, I think, which would encourage that opportunity to communicate with one another, would be a welcome relief.
Mr. Brodsky.
I can say that that as an association, that's not an issue that we have voted on, so I won't speak on behalf of the association. I can tell you my personal feelings, because I've heard that issue come up before in other committees. I think I personally would have strong reservations about it. I think if we could walk out of the room knowing that we haven't reached an agreement and it's not non-binding, kind of like non-binding arbitration or mediation, that would probably be acceptable for us to be able to come together. We encourage that in my office. We bring the attorneys together, the public defenders together, regional counsel together to try to mediate and discuss cases and come to a resolution. But if we don't agree, we walk out of the room. The problem that I have is if it was binding and the mediator could enforce the resolution, there's no, in my opinion, there's no accountability by a mediator. They're not held accountable to the public, and they don't answer to the public. And so to me, that makes it not appropriate, because you know, we feel that there could be outcomes that are adverse and that are contrary to the best interests of the people of the state of Florida, and we have really no repercussion with somebody that's not held accountable to the public.
Representative Driscoll, you had a question?
Thanks, yes. I wanted to follow up on Rep. Beltran's questions about masks, because as was mentioned, if it's a personal choice, that's probably because everybody has different comfort levels. My question is, so when we fly, for example, you're required to wear a mask. The FAA requires it. But if you're eating or drinking, it's okay to take your mask off for a short amount of time and then put it back on once you've done your business. Is there any reason why the court could not consider a similar adjustment for witnesses, perhaps, who need to testify, or any party who wanted to speak in a case?
I think that's an excellent question, and I've always thought that that's a great suggestion, but there haven't been a lot of, there has not, from what I've seen, a lot of willingness to do that. In fact, there's been a lot of discussion more about going to clear masks and the complications with the clear mask fogging and those issues. So there hasn't been much of an acceptance that I've seen of, hey, let's remove the mask to be able to make the identification. Of course, you can't just have the suspect be the only person, or the accused be the only person that removes a mask. And it's, hey, do you see the accused in the courtroom? You know, so, but I do think that that's a very real solution, that where if everybody removes their mask, and then that question could be asked, if the court were to require it, that would be an excellent solution.
Follow up.
So who needs to decide that? Is it the chief judge in each jurisdiction, or is this something for your commission to consider, Judge Munyon?
You recognize Judge Munyon?
Thank you. The administrative order that was issued by the Supreme Court permits the chief judges within boundaries to decide whether masks should be required in the courthouse and or social distancing. If masks are required, the administrative order indicates that it should be uniform in the building and from courtroom to courtroom so that one judge can't have a different rule than another judge, giving no certainty to anybody that comes into the courtroom. The administrative order also allows for clear masks if it's needed for witnesses, jurors, others that need their facial expressions to be shown if masks are required. Mm-hmm. I do know that there are courtrooms where if an identification is necessary, a mask are temporarily not donned or taken off.
Right.
I do know anecdotally that that does occur.
Mr. Dimick.
Just very briefly. It goes beyond just the identification of the defendant or being able to watch the witness testifying. During jury selection, the voir dire process, the lawyers are going to want to see the faces of every juror, not just the one who is responding to the question, but also to the others. We get a lot of feedback about jurors from watching their facial expressions. During the testimony, being able to watch the facial expressions of jurors. So jurors are some of the individuals in court that the lawyers really need to be able to see their faces the entire time. Yes, I think there needs to be discretion that's available. The clear masks or something that can be tried. Some courtrooms in this state, I mean, jurors, judges are in a plexiglass, cell almost. Whether or not that's been adequately explored in terms of whether or not that provides adequate protection, I think options that are available, but at all times making sure that we're able to see those things that are necessary to ensure due process during the course of a trial.
Which I think in response, I think you're right. Got to get creative, got to explore, but do have to strike balances. And I think in some instances, it's hard enough to get jurors to want to be there. And if you have jurors, particularly those who are elderly or have underlying health conditions or things that you just may not be, we just may not be aware of. We never know what a person's going through. We have to think through how to be accommodating while also meeting those needs. It just strikes me as the wrong balance to go to zero mask, because I can imagine that there are people in the public who will not feel comfortable with that, which could also lead to an undermining of the process, right? I'm gonna do whatever I gotta do to get out of here as fast as I can. And that's certainly not what we want. So we have to think through maybe no masks, all masks. Maybe those are the two extremes, but can we find something that's more of a compromise in the middle? And it sounds like you got to work it out with the Chief Justice, in my humble opinion.
Representative Brannon, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a real dumb question. I'm not a lawyer. I am married to one, but I'm not a lawyer. We've heard all these problems that the pandemic has caused, whether it be speedy trial issues or mask issues. And the answer to it is getting back open. That's the bottom line. What is the one major factor that's keeping a lid on everything? I mean, look around. We're here today, and I'm not picking on the court system. I went to a supervisor of elections office the other day, and they cracked the door and handed me a piece of paper. They wouldn't let me in. I walked across the street and walked in Sonny's Barbecue. It made no sense to me. So we hear Florida's open for business, but apparently it's not fully open for business, especially in government sectors. And once again, I'm not picking on the court, but it seems like the court is being sort of the slowest to get back up to speed. And I'm all for technology, and I agree with what Representative Beltran said, but I worry that we do get lazy, that the judge can do first appearance from another state. The prosecutor can be on his couch with his tie on and his pajama bottoms on, sitting on the couch doing first appearances. So the answer is getting back open. So is it, who's keeping the lid on it? Is it the Supreme Court? The other thing that worries me is the differences between the circuits. Some circuits are doing better, some circuits aren't. My wife picked a jury in person yesterday. She's got an in-person trial tomorrow. They've had a lot of trials. So if you could boil it down to one thing and make it simple for me, what is keeping us from the big factor from getting back open?
Judge Munyon, recognize.
Thank you. I think we were pretty much poised to be open until we got the upsurge in the Delta variant. We are still largely open in some circuits. Some circuits are less open because of the COVID numbers. I will tell you this. Unlike Sunny's, where you can choose to go or not go, you can choose to get takeout, you can send your husband to pick up the takeout, or you can, you know, go in and sit down with your six or seven closest friends. The court system demands at the almost at the point of a gun, but certainly you could be arrested if you don't abide by a summons or abide by a notice of or a court appearance, an arraignment date in a criminal case. So we require people to come regardless of whether they want to do it or not. So it gives us a little bit more responsibility in making sure that when we demand someone come, whether they want to or not, that we can do it safely.
One follow-up. The voters, the speaker, whoever required that I be here today, and I'm here. So we make requirements in all sectors. So, yeah, that's an excuse, but I don't know that that's really, really a good one. We've got to get back open. It solves all the problems.
And I think many of us are largely open. We're picking a death penalty jury in our circuit today.
Representative Diamond, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I enjoyed the discussion. If I could just shift the conversation a bit to an issue that I've been interested in and relating to the funding of the clerk of courts and what we've seen with regard to the pandemic. I read the Chief Justice's letter last year to the governor about the fiscal crisis that was created, you know, because we didn't have the adequate fees being collected to fund the clerks. And going back to the representative's questions about what's holding us back, could we have some discussion, or maybe Clerk Baxley, you could start. I mean, hasn't this pandemic highlighted the challenges we have with our current model of funding the clerk of courts? And don't we need to have some discussion as a legislature about whether we go back to where we were with regard to the funding of the clerk of courts through the legislative appropriation process in Chapter 216?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Had lots of discussions with you, Representative Diamond, and thank you for that. I think we could sit here for another hour and a half and opine on this. There's a lot more to this than making some simple changes. Right now, based upon the finite amount of fees that are being collected, I think the only option that we have to increase the funding and do a better job continuing to help folks in the state of Florida is to change the distribution. And that's something that a lot of people have some heartburn with. And I don't blame them, but I'm very sensitive to all of the people that share in the big piece of pie that, $800 million that's collected by clerks of court for all the fees that roll in from the justice system. But all the people sitting next to me right here are all recipients of a part of that. So, like I said before, there's winners and losers, and just simply increasing a fee, I think, has got some inherent danger to it. And I'm just concerned about that. And I know a lot of my my Republican and conservative colleagues are going to have a lot of heartburn with that as well. Not to say that it's not a good idea or it shouldn't be discussed, but it's a concern, no question.
Yes,
Paul.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, Clerk, and I've appreciated our discussions. It's from my perspective, the impact of the increase in fees on access to justice, there's no partisan issue there. I mean, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives care about that issue, but I'm talking about the legislative appropriation of funds to support the operation of the clerks to work through this backlog. I mean, it just seems to me that I'm just hearing that concern often from the, you know, the folks in my circuit.
Yeah, it's a different matter altogether, and I think you're absolutely right. Not that you guys haven't done a wonderful job for us, but I think to get to the point where we're happy and the fees stay the same, an additional appropriation by the Florida legislature will be necessary to make that happen, and I think that's where you're going, and I'm all for it, but I'm not sure if the members of the Florida legislature are. So it's tough writing a check for anything. This is a pretty important check. And you and I have talked about this a lot of times, and I know that you and your clerk have as well. And maybe the time is now. And we will certainly work within the confines of what we have. But, man, I sure would like to do more for the people. And going back to what the judge said about the additional assets that are going to be requested for the judiciary as far as case managers, senior judges, et cetera, we definitely need to be parties to that discussion as well, because if you go from 250 court events to 500 in a week in a county and different courtrooms and hearing rooms and everything else, that's got to be covered by the folks in our offices as well. So some consideration there would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Byrd, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, all of you, for being here. Article 1, Section 21 of the Florida Constitution says the court shall be open to every person for redress of any injury, and justice shall be administered without sale, denial, or delay. And I think based upon your testimony today, and for those of us who are practitioners, we know that justice has been delayed in the state of Florida. My question is this: have any of you looked or examined at what other states have done, and are any other states doing it better? What can we learn from them if we are, so we can stop delaying justice in our state?
And just so everybody has an idea, we have about 4 minutes before the meeting time will expire, so brevity is appreciated.
All right, thank you. And thank you, Representative Byrd. Yes, we did look at what other states were doing, and we even looked around the world to see what courts in other jurisdictions in other countries were doing to keep open and to keep people safe during the pandemic. We incorporated some of the best practices from those other states or nations, and others didn't have particularly helpful information. If you practice in federal court, you know that it depends on which federal judge you're before regarding what happens in that courtroom, and there is no predictability with regard to what happens in a particular courthouse, district, and that is not the approach that the Chief Justice wanted to take.
Follow up, and I think it's important for the members as we consider different alternatives, and you know, there's been some discussion of masks and video conferencing, and video conferencing, while I have found it beneficial in some situations, I mean, we have not suspended the Constitution because of the pandemic. It is still in effect. And Justice Scalia said, the right to meet face-to-face all those who appear and give evidence at trial, there is something deep in human nature that regards face-to-face confrontation between accused and accusers as essential to a fair trial and a criminal prosecution, and that a witness may feel quite differently when he has to repeat his story looking at the man whom he will harm greatly by distorting or misstating the facts. He further added, it is always more difficult to tell a lie about a person to his face than behind his back. And I think, Mr. Deming, you kind of touched on that. And it's just important as we continue this conversation to not forget that we have a constitution and a republic we are administering, and that we can't look for the easy solutions. We have to look for the constitutional solutions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I thank you for your comments and wrapping up this conversation. I want to thank all of the members of our panel for engaging with me in the last week and a half in this discussion and being involved and trying to be part of the solution as we move through all this. Members, I want to thank all of you for being engaged in the discussion today, taking this seriously and understanding the implications that you know any interference with our justice system has on the state of Florida and the citizens of the state of Florida. So I appreciate all of you very much. And with that, Representative Brannon moves we rise. And without objection, the meeting is adjourned.